So I am, just this morning I offered to give this talk because Kurt circulated the email of people who had been drafted to give talks next week, and I'm not here next week, and I didn't want to be labeled a draft dodger, because in the United States that's generally a bad thing to be. Also, I know Art is giving a Blackboard talk next week, and I'm sorry, I'll be not a Blackboard talk, a seminar. Okay.
Monday is a Blackboard talk.
Okay, yes.
Isn't Monday a holiday?
Not here.
At least
well, is today a holiday?
Not here. So it's now announced with my name, and then Monday I have a holiday. I take off.
No, they don't have the
And actually, you see, there's a wine and cheese on Monday as well, isn't there? So if you come into work on the holiday, you get a reward at the end. So
fair enough.
I will miss it. I'll be in San Francisco at the MRS. So pity me, pity me. So I offered to do this partly because I know Art's talk is going to give a lot of warnings and a lot of caveats. So it's a little bit like Banquo's ghost in Macbeth. And I don't want him to be the only ghost. So I thought I'd be a kind of herald of the ghost to come. And warn you about the dangers of large time steps. So in coarse graining, of course, having accomplished some kind of coarse graining, then you'll get the benefits of this coarse graining in using some kind of accelerated dynamics, and you'll be able to hopefully increase the time step. And I wanted to give an example of where this has not worked out well in the past, just because I guess people are a little over optimistic about the kinds of time step you can use. What I'm going to tell you is not radically new. Actually, it may be familiar to all of you. I hope if it's very familiar to all of you, then you won't be too disappointed, because what I'm going to tell you is pretty elementary. I'm just putting together several bits and pieces from different simulation schemes. So first of all, I wanted to remind you about Metropolis. Metropolis Hastings, where we choose to make moves in Monte Carlo, and we write an acceptance criterion. I'll write it. An acceptance probability for moving from the old state to the new state, which in the usual Metropolis language is min of 1, and then e to the minus beta delta U, where U is the potential energy. So I'm going to imagine a system whose potential energy is of interest. And then, very importantly, a ratio of factors that correct for any bias that there might be in selecting the moves. So this would be, I call these factors alpha, alpha old to new on the bottom, and alpha new to old on the top. Sometimes in Monte Carlo there is no bias, and these two factors cancel. So they represent the probability of selecting the trial moves, forward and reverse. And normally in Monte Carlo, if you have some kind of bias, you have a little extra work to do when you reach the new state to calculate the bias that would have been applied if you are attempting the reverse move back to the old state again. I'm only going to be considering moves in which the atoms in the system are displaced according to some Gaussian distribution of displacements, spherically symmetric Gaussian distribution. So I'm going to be considering delta r's. This will represent all of the coordinates. I'll call this, that looks a little funny. It's meant to be a slightly curly r. A random displacement, which is proportional to some Gaussian. So this is, I'll actually put a little standard state symbol there to remind everybody I used to be a chemist once. But this isn't a Gibbs free energy, this is a unit Gaussian of unit variance and zero mean, multiplied by something which gives you the mean squared displacement. And for what I hope are obvious reasons, I'm going to call that square root of 2 d delta t, where you can recognize this as a diffusion coefficient and this as a time step, but you don't have to if you don't want to. They'll always appear together. And in Monte Carlo, of course, the time doesn't have any real meaning, so this really is a single parameter of a Monte Carlo scheme. Then secondly, I want to write down the equations for doing Brownian dynamics. And smart Monte Carlo. Smart Monte Carlo was originally proposed, 1978, I think, by Roskidol and Friedman a long time ago, when they pointed out that it was essentially equivalent to Brownian dynamics, but with an acceptance rejection criterion on the moves, which is missing from Brownian dynamics. And that's really the only difference between them. And so you write this down, and it is R mu equals R old plus beta delta T D, same combination, times the force, force old, plus this random displacement given by the formula I've just given here. Now, they actually wrote this down quite generally, where this could represent a single particle move, or indeed you could think of moving multiple particles. I shall concentrate on the situation where you're moving all of the particles at once, which is just a special case of smart Monte Carlo, but it corresponds to exactly what we do in Brownian dynamics. Now, of course, as you can see, that's a biased Monte Carlo move. In the sense that if this term were missing, this term in the middle, it would be an unbiased Monte Carlo move, but it's biased because of this term which directs the move in the direction of the old forces, which is the whole point of smart Monte Carlo. You improve the acceptance rate by biasing the moves in the direction that the forces would like the particles to go. And so in smart Monte Carlo, Roskidol and Friedman wrote down the acceptance criterion with these factors included in it. And as they wrote it down, those factors are quite complicated. You can calculate them because this minus this is just the displacement. This was the random number. And so the statistical properties of the displacement minus this quantity are the statistical properties of this Gaussian distribution. And from that, you can deduce the probability of making that displacement. And more importantly, you can calculate the probability of making the reverse displacement by using the same kind of formula. So you need the ratio of those two things. And it's proportional to an exponential, of course, because the original formula is a Gaussian. And the quantity that goes into the exponential is this displacement minus this term here, beta delta T D F old squared divided by the normalizing factor, which is actually twice the mean squared displacement, so it's this. And there's a minus sign, of course, here in front of the whole thing. And then there's a similar formula for the reverse, and then the ratio of those two things goes into here, and then it satisfies detailed balance. And part of their paper was just showing that as long as the steps are small, that the acceptance rate actually becomes quite high. It tends to 1 quadratically as you make the so-called time step smaller, or if you like, as you make the displacement smaller. But also in their paper, they pointed out an interesting thing. Almost as an aside, they pointed out that you can think of this as being a kind of molecular dynamics, not Brownian dynamics. That is, you can identify this term here as being the momentum term in a molecular dynamics scheme, and this term here as being the force term in a molecular dynamics scheme. Specifically, you can write down beta delta T D this coefficient here. You can simply define that to be, I've lost my place. Yeah, here we are, half delta t squared over m. So you're basically replacing the diffusion coefficient by a mass. Now the equations that I've written down here have no mass in them. If you like, these Brownian dynamics equations correspond to the Langevin equation without inertia. So they are the simplest kind of coarse grain dynamics you can think of, pretty much, almost the simplest. But now we've introduced a sort of artificial mass here, just by definition. Combination of the temperature, 1 over the temperature, beta, of course, 1 over kT, and the diffusion coefficient. And you can recognize the random number there as being related to a momentum, because if you define a momentum, let's call it P old, just for formality's sake. If you are generating random momenta from the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, then they would be square root of mkt times a Gaussian, unit variance Gaussian, which, if you look at the definition of our random number over there, is m over delta t times r. So actually you can rewrite that equation that I've given you for the displacement in terms of a momentum. So we can say r new equals r old plus that term involving the force then becomes a half delta t squared f over m, f old over m. And then the term involving the random numbers becomes this extra term, delta t p old over m. And you can recognize there the first half of the velocity-Verlet algorithm. And they pointed that out in their paper way back. They didn't actually do anything more with that. They just said, this is interesting. However, if you write the second half of the velocity-Verlet algorithm, you can achieve a simplification of what they wrote. You can make a link with hybrid Monte Carlo. And that is, this is the usual form. It's the average of the contributions from old and new forces. New forces are calculated in terms of the new positions here. Now, in Brownian dynamics, we have no use for this equation. And in smart Monte Carlo, we have no use for the new momenta, really, because we're going to throw them away in a minute and reselect the momenta from a new Gaussian distribution. However, they do make this awful formula a little simpler. And that's the main idea here, because then you can see that alpha old to new, as you might guess, is proportional to the exponential of minus p old squared over, well, not surprisingly, if you convert the symbols, it's p old squared over 2mkt. So, of course, it's e to the minus k old, kinetic energy old, over kt. And that makes the link with hybrid Monte Carlo. If you remember, hybrid Monte Carlo consists of taking a molecular dynamics system, at the beginning of the step, selecting the momenta from a Gaussian distribution, propagating forward by some time step, which can be quite large, and then calculating the change in the Hamiltonian where H is U plus K here. And you can see that's exactly what we do in Brownian dynamics. Well, actually, it's exactly what we do in smart Monte Carlo here, because this ratio here turns into the exponential of the kinetic part of the Hamiltonian, and we've already got the potential part. Now, this link with hybrid Monte Carlo, the fact that hybrid Monte Carlo and smart Monte Carlo, and indeed, if you like, a metropolized thermostated velocity relay molecular dynamics, they're all exactly equivalent, that was recognized about 20 years ago in a paper, but it's not commonly cited. And I have the impression many people aren't quite aware of it. I mean, most people will say something like, oh, yes, 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 these methods are all basically equivalent. But I don't think people have really realized as yet that they are basically identical.
I have a question, though. So does this require assumption on your how large your delta t is? I mean, there should be a correlation, right, in the momentum process. And if you're just resampling, you're not going to capture those correlations. So where does that?
Well, in terms of the time evolution, of course, there will be a difference in the time evolution with delta t as you change delta t. So I'm actually not concerned with the time evolution. I'm mainly concerned with the correct sampling of the equilibrium properties. Okay.
Sure.
So I'm sure.
Equivalence, you mean at the level of the transition probabilities and not at the level of.
Exactly. Yes, exactly so. Yes. So I mean equivalent from the point of view of generating configurations. Mm-hmm. And correctly from a Boltzmann distribution of configuration. So that's quite right, yes. Obviously, the temptation is to use large time steps, and you can still satisfy detailed balance by correctly applying the Metropolis prescription. But the point I'm making, of course, is that that's not what you do in Brownian dynamics. In Brownian dynamics, you apply this formula here without rejecting any moves. So, why is that important? Well, what I wanted to say was that to an extent you can quantify the effects of this in your simulations, at least under certain circumstances. You can quantify how wrong you're likely to be as you increase the time step. So I wanted to take you through the logic of that and give you an example. Now, the example I'm going to give is actually from DPD, from dissipative particle dynamics. Now, I'm not going to write down all of the DPD equations here. Probably most of you know what they are anyway. But just to put it in the context of this, DPD is a stochastic simulation technique with inertia. It has the inertia terms in it. But in a certain limit, when you choose the parameters appropriately, you can go to the limit of the Langevin equation without inertia. That is in the limit of heavy thermostating, I would say, in that limit. That may not be what you want to do, but usually from the point of view of generating correctly sampled configurations, that will be the good limit to be in, the limit in which there are no inertial effects, the limit in which the Langevin equation without inertia applies. Also, in parentheses, of course, DPD is like a pairwise version of the Langevin equation. That's one of its advantages. But I'm not going to make any reference to that at all. So just pretend for the moment that DPD is just like doing Brownian dynamics in a certain limit. DPD is where I'm going to take the example from.
So Mike, isn't it the case that what DPD is really two things, right? One is some kind of potential, and the second thing is a thermostat.
Yes.
That conserves momentum. Yes. So those are two different, and I like to think of them as two completely separate innovations. And then all that the thermostat is a way of generating canonical ensemble averages rather than so if you do a microcanonical MD, then inertia is in there, right?
Yeah.
So the problem is that when you thermostat, then on some time scale or some length scale, your momentum correlations are gone, and so you lose your hydrodynamic basically.
Yes.
And so all that DPD is a way of thermostating that doesn't me throw away your hydrodynamics.
That's exactly right.
So there shouldn't be a problem. You're not introducing inertia. You're actually just going back to what the Newton's equations of motion give. That's another way of thinking of it.
I suppose that is another way of thinking of it. Yeah. So I'll be, my interest in this is just to give it as an example and to show it as a case where the equilibrium ensemble averages are incorrect because of the use of too large a time step. So the third thing about DPD is you never reject any of the steps, or indeed do any reweighting.
But like, it's just because it's just an MD scheme, essentially.
Exactly.
Special thermostat.
Yeah, yeah. It's a non-metropolized MD scheme with an appropriate thermostat. So I'll just remind you of the, one of the things that I just mentioned, that is the potential is really simple. It's really coarse-grained. This is F as a function of distance. The force is linear, and that corresponds to a potential, which is quadratic down to the minimum, and then stops. So it's a half quadratic potential that's displaced along the R-axis, and crosses the R equals zero axis at some point. People often worry a little bit about that. It means particles can pass through each other, but remember, in three dimensions, actually passing over this point is not likely ever to occur, but it's true, particles can approach arbitrarily closely to each other without the potential going to infinity. So it's very, very soft, and you would think that you can use a really long time step with this, and you can, but there are some limits, and I'll show you how you can just push those limits a little bit too far and how you can quantify things a little bit. One of the methods I'll be using to quantify this is the configurational temperature, which I ought to just mention. It's at least one parameter which you can measure for a configuration of atoms, an average over configurations in the canonical ensemble. It's a way of defining the temperature, which is pretty well known now. It's a ratio of squared gradients of the Hamiltonian, so dH by dR. I'll put RI alpha here to emphasize we're looking at one component XYZ of one particle's position, but this can certainly be averaged over particles and Cartesian coordinate directions. So this thing at the top is a squared force, averaged, divided by the Laplacian. The same coordinate, d2h by dr squared. And these are canonical ensemble averages. Normally, of course, this will just be the potential energy part. In fact, I may as well put that in now, because our systems just have separable potential and kinetic energies, and nothing fancy about them. But it gives a way of estimating the temperature from the configurational variables only. And it's of interest to know when this quantity is different from the kinetic value, kt, let's call it kt kinetic, which of course is just the average of p squared, again for one component, I alpha, divided by m, actually. Yeah, half kt per degree of freedom. So there we go. This has been around a long time, usually credited to Hirschfelder back in 1960. Actually, Bill Hoover found the appropriate hyperviral equation in Landau and Lifshitz, which dates from before 1960. So this is yet another proof of that thing. If you think you discovered something, look in Landau and Lifshitz first. You'll probably find they got there first. But the interesting aspect of this was not so much that the hyperviral relation was known, because this is even, the hyperviral equation has been known even in certain old books on simulations, naming no names, but my own. Without the authors realizing that it could be useful. And really the breakthrough came when people realized that this could be a useful way of actually estimating the temperature. And that didn't happen until much later. So I'll be referring to this. So time to show you some results. Oh, let me show you what I'm going to be discussing. I'm going to be discussing a DPD model in which the beads interact by this form, by this potential here, with various strengths and with a certain cutoff. The cutoff will always be the same. We choose a cutoff to be one unit. And the simulations involved here were simulations of lipids forming a membrane. This particular one has a head bead, H, and then six tail beads, tail one down to tail six. Joined together by springs, so it's a really simple bead spring model. And it's in a solvent of water, again, water in quotes, interacting by another potential just like this. And the interaction parameters you can find in tables, but typically the interactions between these beads are quite strong and repulsive. The head bead interacts less strongly with the water, which effectively means that it's hydrophilic. And the water interaction is less strong than the hydrophobic tails here. So everything is repulsive, but the water and the hydrophilic units are less repulsive than the others. And this system is one of the standard DPD models brought up by Berenschmidt, I think, and also studied by Lipovsky's group, I think, with DPD. And also, at some point, by Gerhard Bezold and Ole Moritzen and collaborators. So let's see if I can firstly wake this up and then move it out of the way, show you some pictures. Yeah. Good. Now, so here we are. Oh, screen. Oh. So this is just water on its own, and for the classic sort of parameters in DPD for water, this classic paper by Groot and Warren recommended certain parameters, including the time step in DPD simulations, and their criterion for the time step was based on how well the temperature, the kinetic temperature, was consistent with the value that was input into the dynamics. They required this kinetic temperature to be within 2 or 3% of the specified value, which is 1. And they recommended a time step in the range in reduced units of 0.04, 0.05, 0.06, somewhere down here on this scale. And indeed, you can see that for the integration algorithm they used, which is not exactly velocity Verlet, because remember, this has inertia built into it. And because of the velocity-dependent forces, you have to meddle a little bit with the velocity Verlet to get good conservation. But that's probably not the main point here. But it explains partly why there's a little bit of a dip here and then a little bit of a rise there. But over this whole range, certainly the output temperature is within a few percent, 2 to 3% of the input temperature. And unfortunately, though, when I measure the configurational temperature for this system, you'll see the configurational temperature is not within just a few percent. By the time you're using time steps at the upper end of the recommended range, the configurational temperature is over 10% larger than the input temperature. So if that configurational property is out by 10%, then probably some other configurational properties are also a little bit out. Now, frankly, this may be acceptable. I mean, this, remember, this is an approximate coarse-grained method. But anyway, it's as well to know that. More seriously, here's this model I was talking about. Berenschmidt's group, Shilcott and Posky. Here's the water beads. The thing spontaneously forms a... Oh, yes, thank you. Spontaneously forms a bilayer. The dark blue beads are the hydrophilic head groups, and then the tail groups are just coloured in yellows and oranges and reds, depending how far down the chain they are. But there's a basically a bilayer formed here. What Moritzen and Bezold found was that the kinetic temperature of these different beads was different depending on where they were in the chain, which was a worry. They also measured the stress and found that the stress profiles depended on the time step. And now stress profiles are very important in membrane simulations, as we know. They give the surface tension. There's also a lot of interest in how they vary with position here. There's some biological interest in what the actual transverse stress is like for different particles embedded in these membranes. They found they varied significantly with the time step, so that indicates something going wrong. And then in due course, I got around to measuring the configurational temperature for these things and found that they also vary quite strongly depending on the species. And here's a typical result. Don't worry too much about these other things here. These are other thermostats. You can control the configurational temperature if you like, rather than the kinetic one. And that gives you something else, but not good. And you can try and control both of them. It's a little bit like squeezing the toothpaste in the tube. If you squeeze it in the middle, it's going to shoot out both ends. And this is sort of what's happening here, but this is the basic curve that you get here. Don't worry about the open circles, but the darks, oh yeah, no, wait a sec, that's right, the dark circles are the configurational temperatures, the open circles are the kinetic temperatures. And you can see here, the water, the blue curves here, are still reasonably well behaved in this system, but the other beads, the beads actually in the lipids, are increasingly badly behaved. Temperatures typically being too high, configurational temperatures typically being much too high, up to 20 or 30%. Now, I hasten to say the reasons for this is not rocket science. The reasons are the time steps are too big for the potentials that are involved in the model. It's nothing specific to DPD. It is simply looking at the potentials, the strengths of the springs, and comparing it with the time steps. Those are the only reasons these are happening. And you can tell something like that by plotting, and this is in this limit of heavily thermalized velocities. So you'd expect to get exactly the same out of a Brownian dynamics simulation with the same time step. Or unmetropolized molecular dynamics that was thermostated very heavily. The configurational temperature, if you plot one over it against the square of the time step, you get a straight line. More specifically, you get different straight lines for different species in the system. So for the water, you get a rather shallow gradient here. For the groups at the ends of the chains, the head group and the terminal tail group, you get another straight line. And then the further in you go, T1 and T5, those are second in, and then T2, T3, and T4, those are third in and fourth in, the gradient increases. And the reason is very simple. The ones in the middle have more potential energies acting on them, in particular springs, but also some bending terms, which affect the ones in the middle, but not the ones on the outside so much. Why is it straight? Well, now that's an interesting question. I want to go to a really simple system where you can explain a little bit what's going on. And this is why I'm suggesting that there may be ways of estimating and correcting for this kind of effect. It's our old friend, the harmonic oscillator, for which you can see what's going on exactly. So consider a simple harmonic oscillator, natural frequency omega. It's a single bond, if you like. Here are the equations of motion. I'm sure those aren't new to you. But the important point is that velocity Verlet, which remember is what we're implementing when we do Brownian dynamics or smart Monte Carlo or whatever, it conserves not this Hamiltonian, but a shadow Hamiltonian, which is close to the true Hamiltonian. It's within order delta t squared of the true Hamiltonian. And for the harmonic oscillator, you can actually write down what that shadow Hamiltonian is exactly. This is rare. Normally, the best you can hope for is to get some kind of series expansion in increasing derivatives of the potential. But in this case, it turns out to be really simple. It's like the original Hamiltonian, but with an extra constant term multiplying or dividing one of the terms. And for convenience, I put it over here on the potential part. But there's no reason for that, apart from convenience in what follows. You could equally well take this term and have it as a divisor on the first term. Or some people write it down split between the two. You take the square root of this and you put one of the square roots over here and the other square root under there. Remember, there's no direct relationship between this and this except in the limit delta t goes to zero. So to an extent, it's arbitrary what you term the Hamiltonian. All you know is that this is conserved by the dynamics. But it is interesting to write it down like this, because this is a constant for a constant time step, and so you're conserving a Hamiltonian that's not exactly the correct Hamiltonian, but is close to it, and that, of course, is the reason why velocity Verlet is a very good algorithm to use in molecular dynamics. And here's the typical dynamics that you get. I put this up when I'm lecturing to my graduate students about this. This is the phase portrait for a harmonic oscillator. I've drawn it so that it's a circle, this black circle here. But for velocity Verlet dynamics of the same system with a finite time step, I've chosen a really large time step here. Omega delta t is pi over 3. This is much, much bigger than you would use in practice. But it helps to exaggerate the effect. You get an elliptical phase portrait, which the dynamics, of course, samples in a discrete way. So velocity Verlet operates in this sort of way. It goes from step one to step two by taking a step along P, that's the kick, and then a drift along the positional coordinate, and then another kick, and that takes you to this position on the ellipse. And you end up exactly on the ellipse. And then again, kick, drift, kick, and you end up exactly on the ellipse again, and so on, and so on, and so on. So this is what's conserved. This is the hypersurface that you're probing with velocity Verlet. But for our purposes, what I want to point out is that you can work out canonical ensemble averages using this surface instead of that one. Of course, incidentally, with velocity Verlet, even though it is stable, you can, if you like, crank up the step so large that this term becomes negative, in which case that ellipse will turn into a hyperbola. And as far as the dynamics is concerned, everything will be just fine, and this shadow Hamiltonian will still be preserved very well. But as far as the bond length is concerned, you'll find it becomes infinite. So physically, that won't be good news. Okay, remember again, here's the true Hamiltonian. Here's the shadow Hamiltonian. And because of this unique thing for the harmonic oscillator, the fact that the shadow Hamiltonian has split into two separate parts, independent parts, which is not at all guaranteed, and that also both of these parts have the same form as the original potential and kinetic energies, but there's just a pre-multiplying factor with one of them. That, again, is not to be expected in general. But because of this particular form, you can think of it, you can write it as the original exact kinetic energy plus a kind of shadow potential energy. And it doesn't require a lot of thought to realize then that if you're sampling this, but putting a thermostat in there, which thermostats every step, then you're generating configurations and momenta from this product distribution here. The momenta will be generated from the correct distribution, and the configurations will be generated from the shadow potential distribution. So this gives you a way of seeing how wrong they will be, and also potentially, of course, correcting them. We can understand where that plot of configurational temperature against T squared came from by just applying equipartition of energy to that shadow Hamiltonian. P squared over 2m equals the usual potential energy with this extra factor built in, and then you can work out what the forces and the Laplacians are for this system here. They're not surprising, the force is proportional to the displacement, so the Laplacian is a constant, and you get these formula here. Not surprisingly, the kinetic temperature is exactly the input temperature of the thermostat, but the configurational temperature is divided by this factor here. So that gives you an estimate of how wrong the configurational temperature will be if your system is harmonic. And if, as in my case, it was largely harmonic but with a set of different, basically different atoms in a different harmonic potential, the water, more or less just surrounded by other waters in a kind of soft harmonic-like potential, and then the other beads, which are in a similar kind of environment but then had the additional intramolecular bonds to just pile on top of that, then you can see that the natural frequencies of vibration will be higher and higher and higher, and the deviation from the correct thermostatic temperature would be stronger and stronger.
Mark,
so, yeah?
You would have made now the split in your shadow Hamiltonian differently, then you would have concluded that the kinetic temperature would be wrong. But you measure actually...
No, I wouldn't, because I've defined it with the thermostat. So that's why I chose that splitting. I've chosen the Hamiltonian there so that the kinetic energy part of it went with the temperature of the thermostat. So in fact, that's the way to do it. I think that's the simplest way to think of it. Yeah. So what's the bottom line here? Bottom line is that you probably should thermostat, probably should metropolize your dynamics if you want to guarantee generating correct ensemble averages. Some people looking at dynamics don't like to do that because rejecting a move in dynamics sounds like a very drastic thing to do. I don't think it's impossible to take the other route, and that is to simply reweight configurations that are generated by this kind of dynamics. Because after all, from one step to the next, you can very easily monitor the change in the Hamiltonian that is that's carried out with the dynamical part of the algorithm, that is the non-thermostatic part.
When you do this re-rating, that you can do when you want to get an average and have a simulation of an equilibrium system.
Yes.
If you have a system which drives somewhere, then this creates problems.
Yes, I would think it would. Yes. Yeah. But then, you mean when the Hamiltonian actually changes as you're going from one state to another, when the value of the Hamiltonian actually changes as you go forward. That might be true, but then that's taking it outside everything I'm talking about here. I think everything I'm talking about here is supposed to be generating equilibrium ensemble.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah. So I don't think this is going to be a prescription that will help. And there again, you may have other things to look at as well. Depends how you're driving it. I'm talking only about time step effects, of course. So you can perfectly well use Jarzynski or whatever you like to measure work done and changes in free energy along a trajectory, independent of everything I'm saying here, as long as you use a small enough time step. Yes.
No, I'm not quite seeing it. Is that reweighting term now just depending on the configuration, or is that some kind of history-dependent reweighting? So you basically have to follow, so your reweighting term will depend on the move.
Your reweighting term will depend on the move. So it will be just like the reweighting you'd apply in Monte Carlo. And I think the ratio of the forward and backward biases, you can calculate. So it usually, when there's an extra term in the Metropolis prescription for accepting or rejecting a move, it's equally possible to omit that and then include it as a correction to the weighting factor. And what I'm suggesting is that for each of the deterministic parts of the algorithm, you can accumulate the change in the Hamiltonian from, say, some reference point at the start. So that'll be a succession of small delta H's. Of course, in between, you're thermostatting. So that's something completely different. The thermostatting is being done properly. But you can accumulate a set of little delta H's, and at each stage, sum them up and do the exponential, e to the minus delta H over KT. And that will give you a weighting factor for each configuration, which is slightly greater or slightly less than 1, hopefully. Of course, choosing the initial configuration to be 1 is arbitrary. You can choose it to be anything you like, as long as you're also accumulating a normalizing factor at the same time. So I think it should be possible to correct for this in a way that doesn't involve actually rejecting moves. Doesn't make the dynamics any more realistic, of course, but it gives a slightly gentler way of correctly generating ensemble.
But do you think having one weight for a system, like the one that you've showed, that was contained different parts, would fix the whole thing? Or in the best case, you could end up with being one part of the system wrong one way, the other part being wrong the other way, and on average being okay?
Well, I think it should work. I think it should just work, because you're with the remember, the weighting in the Boltzmann distribution is only a function of the energy. And if you're doing Monte Carlo, you'd simply accept or reject on the basis of the total energy, total potential energy. And it's the same here. You're changing the weighting. Whether it be statistically good or not, I don't know. And if you have a lot of contributions that take you a lot outside, the equilibrium distribution, then of course they'll be downweighted a lot. You'll be spending a lot of time simulating configurations that don't contribute very heavily to your average.
Yeah, then we can prune and enrich and blah, blah, blah.
Well, that would be interesting. But if you're happy to do that, then you should be happy just to reject the moves and do what I would call hybrid Monte Carlo, which is what this will boil down to. But I just wanted to give, by linking Brownian dynamics to hybrid or smart Monte Carlo, at least you have the machinery to do that kind of analysis. You don't have to just sit there saying, I wonder if my time step is too long, and then if it is too long, I wonder what I should do about that. This at least gives you a method of doing something about it. So that was.
So what about, you know, designing the thermostat so it takes the time step into account? If you could imagine trying to derive like a fluctuation dissipation principle for the discretized system, so that the stochastic forces then have a delta t correction.
Well, yeah. The thing is, if you knew the correction, that would be possible. But this harmonic oscillator, I think, is the only case. There is some analysis in the literature of the performance of different algorithms, that is, how well they actually conserve the shadow Hamiltonian. And that, unfortunately, involves some expansions of the potential. And you may wonder what I mean by that, because I just said velocity of Verlet exactly conserves the shadow Hamiltonian. But the one thing missing from this is the effect of a cutoff on the potential, that is, discontinuities in higher derivatives of the potential, which we all have. And actually, the DPD potential is no better than other potentials from that point of view. It has a rather obvious discontinuity in the derivative of the force. And that causes the shadow Hamiltonian to vary. Now, so you've got two problems. Firstly, generally, deriving the correct shadow Hamiltonian involves an expansion. Can't be written down as an explicit formula like this, although you could approximate it, I guess, with harmonic potentials. And then secondly, the effects of any discontinuities in higher derivatives of the potential are not taken into account at all in that definition, and indeed the algorithm won't conserve the shadow Hamiltonian exactly because of the discontinuities. So it makes that whole process very tricky, I think.
Going to higher order algorithms, I mean, people were remembered that they were suggesting, I mean, for using a larger time set, you go to higher order algorithms and then cure the problem that way a bit better.
I think that's the sort of thing that would improve some prefactor somewhere, but probably wouldn't change basically what I'm saying here. Hopefully, the higher order algorithms will still conserve a shadow Hamiltonian.
And make the legal expansion so you can construct them to arbitrary order.
Yeah, I think you can, yes. I think it is possible to do that. Might even be possible to do that sort of numerically on the fly or something like that to improve, to reduce the gap between the true Hamiltonian and the shadow Hamiltonian. So that could, but that's the same problem that we face in molecular dynamics anyway. It's you know, how to get the best time step using the best algorithm. I think velocity Verlet is still, you know, pretty widely used. And I don't think any of the higher order algorithms have really taken over from it as being the best one. So there's no reason why that should be different for Brownian dynamics or any other scheme. So what I'm saying is Brownian dynamics doesn't escape from the problem of time step versus getting correct results. And it's important to bear that in mind. And it's often just swept under the carpet. These higher order algorithms. So I think you're probably right.
I remember from the correct algorithms were pretty bad.
Yeah.
I don't remember that I've ever seen people using higher order corrections. I mean, higher order algorithms which preserve the shadow Hamiltonians.
No, there are some. No, there are. There's a whole range of symplectic algorithms of higher and higher order. And certainly they're qualitatively different. What's a quality? I really mean quantitatively different from what you get from predictor corrector, because as you said, they're not symplectic, so they don't preserve this thing. There is a difference. But there's a whole literature on, you know, finding different symplectic algorithms of different orders. In principle, the same analysis should apply to them. Okay. Just out of interest, how many people knew all this already?
Not in that detail. So I thought it was very nice.
Oh, that's a relief. Okay, yes. So I've at least contributed something, even a little bit of, you know, a bucket of cold water in advance of next week. I'm happy next, you know, when I come back, I could talk a little bit more about science. But I thought this was the best thing to do as a quick, you know, not so quick. Okay, let's stop.
Good. Okay.